Hey guys, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Our guest this week is the Turner Sports, CBS Sports, and Westwood One broadcaster Kevin Harlan. You can see him throughout the NBA playoffs on TNT. He is doing a variety of games and series for that network as part of a really interesting and engaging 70-plus minute podcast. We discuss how Kevin prepares differently for both the NFL and the NBA and college basketball. Talk about how really critical Kevin is of his own work, which is surprising given the level that he has reached in the business. We get into how Kevin became a national broadcaster, was obviously very well known in Kansas City, doing Chiefs games and Jayhawks games before he became nationally known. And of course, what Kevin thinks about the call that he made on Monday Night Football last year during a pretty dull game between the 49ers and Rams. And the call went viral of Kevin Harlan giving a play-by-play of a fan being tackled by security. All right, that's all coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast with guest Kevin Harlan. All right, and as promised, we bring in Kevin Harlan, whose world tour has left him now in San Antonio, Texas. He's doing the Spurs game as we tape this on April 17th. As I said at the top, he is, of course, the fine TNT, CBS Sports, and Westwood One broadcaster, and Kevin Harlan joins us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Kevin, good to talk to you today.
Thanks for asking me. I'm a fan of the podcast. I download them into my phone, and when I'm out walking, I'll listen to them. So I was thrilled when you wanted to visit, so thanks for having me on.
Kevin, I know you tell that to every podcaster you do, but I appreciate that all the same. I want to start off with this. You have a crazy schedule this week. As we taped this, you did Rockets Thunder game one at last night, as we're taping this again, as I said, on a Monday. You're doing San Antonio tonight, and then you head back to Houston, Oklahoma City. So that leads me into the question of, you are the personification, I always feel, of a quote unquote working broadcaster. Can you give the audience like a rough idea of how many dates you work each year?
Well, I probably do maybe 80 to 85 different events, and that does not include the NBA 2K video game series that the league and Visual Concepts puts out every year. That's another couple weeks, 3 weeks of recording. Wow. 4 or 5 hours a day. So that's a whole separate entity. But my wife counts them as a work day, so I guess I do too. But I would say, Richard, about in and around 80 games with over 40 NFL games, including playoffs and Super Bowl, 17 weeks of CBS NFL TV, Green Bay Packer preseason football, 3 or 4 games, depending if they've got a national game, full regular season with Turner doing NBA on Thursdays, an occasional Monday or Tuesday, and then all the playoff games, which can vary year to year from as few as 8 and as many as 15 or 16, depending on if a series continues.
Kevin, there's a lot to unpack there, so I'll try to take a couple things one by one. This is very much a process podcast, and there's a lot of people who either want to get into the business or are in the business who listen, and so you are a very interesting guy to talk to on this. First off, as best as you can, are there major differences between the different entities that you work for, meaning do you have to have a certain mindset if you're doing a CBS game versus, say, a Turner basketball game?
Well, it's so interesting that you bring that up, because over the years, I think it has evolved at CBS. When I first got to CBS in 1998, it very much had the feel that Sean McManus was going, reaching back maybe into the Tiffany Network type of respectable, more buttoned down, perhaps of a broadcast, both in college basketball, and I forgot to mention college basketball for CBS because I do that in the tournament.
Right.
And with Turner, it probably has evolved too, where now I think with the arrival of Barkley and crew, that has kind of seeped in maybe to the game broadcast. When Marv came over, you know, he has a very terrific personality that always comes through on the air. And that may have lightened things a little bit. But I would say that in terms of just the mechanics of each, they're pretty much the same, because I always, Richard, kind of headline all the jobs I have, fortunately, as network national broadcasts.
Right.
Thus, you can't be like you would be on a local broadcast, which is perhaps a little bit more inside, a little bit more jovial, maybe even, leaning toward your team to the point where, you would get down or have less gusto for an opponent's play and far more for your teams. So with the network job, I think CBS and Turner kind of are on that same level, that it's been loosened a little bit as the decades have gone by, but there is still a feel that it is a national broadcast, and there has to be a certain decorum that is always there. On the Monday Night Football radio with Boomer or Kurt Warner or Dan Fouts, leading through the playoffs to the Super Bowl, I guess because football lends itself as a more serious, more disciplined, more structured broadcast with a game that maybe doesn't have the breezy back and forth that basketball does, and that there is a certain regiment that radio sports brings nationally, it's maybe a little bit more, has more form to it. But I do sense that in both places I work, CBS and Turner, it has gotten a little bit looser. They at CBS will tell us, don't be afraid to laugh. Show some personality. Don't be inside about, dinner last night, but maybe, have a good chuckle because of something that's come up organically in a game. And certainly the same is true in the NBA, where you can have 30 and 40-point blowouts on national games involving two good teams, and you need to be you got to bring it back a little bit, have a little bit more fun, be more conversational. So, but I do think that has evolved as the media world and all the different platforms we have in front of us have evolved and come into being.
Kevin, I've read some interviews with you where, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I'm right about this, where you said that in terms of the preparation that you do for each sport, and you just listed the numerous sports that you do from NBA basketball to professional football to college basketball, that the NFL is the hardest to prepare for as a play-by-play broadcaster because of the so many potential groups and plays and the fact that the game is just rather complex. One, is that correct? And two, if so, then how do you specifically prepare for the NFL?
It is correct. And you're dealing with, 50-plus players on both sides and changing rosters week by week and maybe doing a team that you haven't seen until week 15 or 16 of the season. And you've got to catch up on all the different angles, stories, opinions, rumors that have woven their way through that team season. The deeper you get into the season, the more complex and the more time I think is probably required. I don't know that there is a day off in the NFL season. I'm sure Ian and Jim and all the people that have done it would say the same thing, that it is a 7-day-a-week job. And for me, then it's compounded by the fact I've got the Monday night game.
Right.
So I do get the benefit of seeing four teams a weekend in person, and that's sure great. That does help, and usually by the week 14, 15, I've seen every team in the league at least once, through the preseason games or through the regular season with radio and TV. So that does aid in the preparation. But because there are so many sub-packages on both offense and defense, and injuries and all the different things that can accumulate week by week, and, Richard, on top of that, just the passionate following that pro football has with fantasy leagues and growing up and rooting for your team, whether it's the Packers, the Steelers, the Giants, or whoever. Those fans, they know every story because they read everything on the internet and in their local papers, and they listen to the talk shows. And our networks expect us as broadcasters to go in there and be ramped up and at full speed when we open that broadcast from that stadium on Sunday afternoon. We need to know everything that they know. And that's a tall order. Plus, I think you feel responsibility because you're so lucky to be in that position, to be one of, what, 16 NFL network play-by-play men, that, you know, you owe it to the broadcast, certainly to your employer, but to those fans that you know what you're talking about. You've got the right pronunciation of names. You know a kid's story and what he's done and can let it fly out as easily as calling a first and 10 handoff. And that's the challenge. And I think all of us that are in that position love that challenge. But it is challenging with a lot of tape watching and a lot of memorization and a lot of reading. The reading is endless. In fact, you're kind of reading, Richard, almost up until kickoff, getting a quick note, a sentence, a stat, something you could put on your spotting boards, file away on your notes, whatever it may be. So it really, it's a never-ending cycle that you need to prepare for NFL football.
Kevin, one of the things that, and again, you've answered this before, but it remains interesting. You've had, I wonder if you've even ever counted, so many partners over the years, given the multiple sports. But the NFL, you know, you and Rich Gannon now have had a little bit of a run. I'll ask this for other sports too, but specific to the NFL, it would strike me that there, given the complexities that you just talked about, there would be a bigger value in having the same partner in the NFL, maybe than if a partner came in for another sport and you guys were just trying to find chemistry. Is that correct, given how complex the NFL is? There's a, you know, I mean, you always want to have the same partner, but it strikes me that it's might even be more important for that sport.
Well, I think you've nailed it. It is a serious sport with attention to detail, probably the first words you write on your to-do list and on your process of preparing. The detail, the devil is in the detail, but the details are foremost at the top of Rich's priority list, and that's the way he kind of became this quarterback from, and journeyman probably isn't fair because he was a mid-round draft choice, was highly thought of when he came out of college, but it took him a while to get traction. And when he got the right coaching staff with the right-minded offensive coordinator and quarterback coach, that's when he began to blossom. But it wasn't until midway through his career, and then certainly when he hit Gruden in Oakland, things all came together. The coach who had the same mindset, wired the same way mentally, and that he could really associate his interest, his desires with a coach that was on that same page. Hmm. And I think that's what has happened to Rich and I, is that I grew up in a football family. I grew up in Green Bay. My dad was a longtime executive with the Green Bay Packers. I was a ball boy at age 10. I was on the sideline for virtually every home game throughout the last part of grade school and high school and into college. I used to chart the offense during training camp. So I grew up around pro football. And I think the thing that perhaps really clicked with Rich and I is that, you know, we've got football backgrounds. We take it seriously. And I appreciate his attention to detail. I appreciate the amount of film, Richard, that he watches every week, the notes he takes. He prepares for our CBS games as he did when he was quarterbacking the Raiders as an MVP in the early 2000s. He has that kind of attention to detail. And that inspires our crew, I think, but it really inspires me. And it makes you want to work even harder. You know, the stories about John Madden and how he would travel on the bus and how he would get to the city early and began to go to practice on Thursdays and Fridays and watch, you know, just hours and hours of tape, and he'd bring all the different people on that crew with him in to watch, and they had big meals at night and they would talk pro football, and then they'd wake up on Saturday and talk more pro football, and it became, you know, kind of the fabric of what they were doing as professionals. But he kind of lured people, he seduced people into gaining his love for the game. I think Rich has done that for me. Not that I could love it any more than I do, but just I'm inspired by the way that he prepares, and it makes me want to prepare even harder. So I love that I love that. If I didn't need a nudge, that certainly serves as a nice nudge and a way to kind of lead me from week to week.
Kevin, how do you feel? How is an NBA broadcast different than an NFL broadcast? And it would strike me, obviously, if, let's forget about obviously the games are different. I'm talking about sort of the rhythms of the broadcasters. The game is much more jazz. The game is the clock is running obviously far more than it does in the NFL. How does, in your opinion, how does that impact the broadcast itself, and particularly the relationship between you and either a singular analyst or two analysts?
Well, well said by you. I was just thinking about this as I was coming into town today, in that doing basketball is kind of like a running conversation because there is so much scoring, but there is a distinct difference between pro basketball and college basketball. And I will tell you that I feel like I struggle with pro basketball because, for whatever reason, the rhythm with which I think it and say it and feel it far more connects with the college game. Longer play clock, slower, less skilled players. They go deeper into the clock. It's not like a track race from baseline to baseline that the NBA is. Really, NBA TV could be like when Emmerich does hockey on the NHL. You could really do almost a radio call of NBA basketball on television because it is one play after another, and you know, you can identify this player, that player, and because we can see the ball going in. We can see the player, but we may not really know who that is. So if you can fill in the gaps as adroitly as you can with the speed of the game, but I do find that the college game, and just having come off the tournament, for me personally, is just easier because there is time to breathe, and it's like sped up football. Because you can put in a dart, I call them darts, little bits of information to accent the previous play, to highlight the guy who's got the ball in his hands, to talk about a trend, put in a team stat, whatever it might be, and still then catch the last couple seconds of the play clock and not overdo play-by-play. You can accent the picture, but you can pick up your rhythm and you can go into it and finish off the play. And then on the back end, you give, because the game is at its pace, you give your analyst time to go in there and talk about that play, you know, gain some perspective with a step back, you know, foreshadow and look ahead. But there is room there. There is not room in the NBA. The game is faster. It is more fluid. And it is hard. So a lot of times, you've got the analyst who is saying, as you see that basket right there by Carmelo Anthony. You know, and then he continues his story. And then you get out of rhythm because the game is still going on. And it's a difficult dance. And I was thinking about this, and I've not felt comfortable doing NBA TV in a while. Now, people say, well, how can that be? Because you might be known most for NBA TV.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
But I'm telling you, I don't feel that way. I feel like when we go to break, I go, I've got to get my rhythm. I've got to get my deliberate pace. And because the play is so helter skelter, you're constantly grasping at those pockets to do what you do so you can get in your rhythm. And you might as well just call it on radio, do a radio call on TV for the NBA because the game is moving now that fast. There is no time for the kind of analysis that maybe the game warrants. And it's kind of a shame. The college game, on the other hand, has, I think, a real nice pace. They don't score as much. They're missing a lot of shots, so there doesn't have to be a lot of explanation about what's going on. It just there just is a better flow in the college game, and I struggle, and I'm conflicted about that every night I put on a headset to do an NBA game.
That's really interesting, Kevin, because I think you would acknowledge that. In terms of being known, whatever that means, in quotes, being known, some of the things you are most famous for are NBA calls or slogans. I mean, I think, and you know, we'll get to the Monday Night Football call of the guy who ran on the field, and we talked about this earlier this year when I wrote a column on that with you, but, you know, the LeBron no regard for human life dunk is probably something when anybody meets you in an airport or in a hotel, they probably refer back to you. So that's That's an interesting observation by you, just given that I think so many people associate you with the NBA and associate you in their minds with your comfort in the NBA.
It is weird, but I will tell you that I am not. I go back and watch and note take, and I try to put my mind back to where I was thinking in that second quarter or in that fourth quarter, and I could pick out a thousand things every broadcast that I do that I would tweak, change, admit, or even embellish or make more prominent every game. And the NBA game just becomes so fast. So, you know, when I finish my NBA run, and I've got it my deal that I can finish after the second round, which goes back to when the kids were smaller and we'd leave for the summer, and I wanted to make sure that I ended at a time when they were getting out of school so that we could leave and go have our summer together and my 2 months off before football began. I watch a lot of Emmerich doing hockey, because I just think he's got it, and it is a radio call, and I don't know how else you would call NHL hockey, because it is so fast, and so it's tough to have flow because there's deflections and there's all kinds of things that go on. But what he does is he's got this like melodic rhythm to his call. It's almost like he's singing it, you know, with his words and his inflection, and he's got it, you know, like that. That's the perfect way to do it. Like he's like, there's one Marv Albert, and there was one Keith Jackson, and there was one there's Ray Scott and Summerall are kind of same style, but there's like one Emmerich, and I just marvel and admire him so much and how he has. He gets it. You know, he's captured exactly what you need to do for hockey that makes it enjoyable for even the casual fan. Whereas the NBA, we are in this time period here over the last 15 years, beginning with the Sacramento Kings in the early 2000s, when the fluid ball movement, spacing, athletic wings, long bodies, less size, more athleticism, all these things have just evolved, the rules changes that now make it what it is today, which is, it's like a circus. And so I almost feel like sometime, well, should I call a game like Emmerich does? Because there's that kind of action. There's very little dead spot. There's very little pocket of breath that you can really have. Mm-hmm. In a close game, you're going back and forth, and you're doing everything just to make sure that you're connecting those dots. This becomes a big issue for me, because we're all perfectionists, regardless of what we're in, and when it consumes you the way it does me, because this is what I've done my whole life since I began broadcasting at about 14 years old, you know, this is all I think about. I think about voices. I think about how these guys do it. I study others. I listen to myself. It's torture to listen to sometimes my games. Rarely do I come off and I pull off the earbuds or the headset and go, you know, I felt pretty good about that, because they're so few and far between. But I do admire the guys that just go in and seamlessly do it. And I say that about Emmerich. He probably puts more time into that broadcast, regardless of who he's doing, regular season or playoff or Stanley Cup, than maybe anybody in the business. And it shows. And I guess that's what pushes me. I thought, you know what? Prepare more. Work harder. Figure out ways to get better. Even if you're in your mid-50s, you still need to push and you still need to evolve.
Yeah, the thing about Emmerich is, and obviously he's sort of the brilliant broadcaster, is I don't know how you can emulate somebody with that kind of vocabulary and that kind of sort of fast twitch brain. But that's well thought out by you in terms of sort of getting a sense of how frenetic his broadcast, or actually like organized frenetic, how his broadcasts are. There's something I wanted to ask you.
Gone to watch him, just out of curiosity, Richie? Have you ever gone to sit in his booth and watch what he does?
I've interviewed him many times, but never in the booth.
I would love to. I'd love to see his note-taking. I'd love to see how he scores a game. I would love to see the way he... Does he glance at his analyst when they talk? Is he watching the monitor? Is he watching the field? Like Al Michaels, I've been told by others... watches about 90% of the game off the monitor. I read someplace where Michael said the reason why I do that is because that's what the fans are seeing. If I'm talking about something that the cameras aren't showing, why am I talking about it? I mean, out of the corner of my eye, I can glance up, but he says, I watch most of the game off the monitor. And I'd love like Scully. I wonder what Scully did. I wonder if Scully watched the monitor. Did he watch the diamond? Baseball is a completely different pace and animal, but Amerik to me would be fascinating to hang with him for a day and just watch what he does to get ready. Cause he's one of a kind, and we may never have one as good as him again.
Lou, are you saying Amerik, I'll have my producer pop in here. You're saying Amerik does, you've been there, he does watch off the monitor?
I have seen Doc call a game when he was doing Devil Games with Chico Resch. This is years ago, and I remember Chico standing to Doc's left and Doc almost having his back to Chico watching the monitor because, as Kevin just said, why am I going to talk about something that's not on the screen that the fans at home are seeing?
Oh, interesting. Thanks, Lou. Gives me an idea to go, obviously, watch a game with Amerik one of these days.
You should. I might join you.
Kevin, your resume obviously speaks for itself. You have multiple national jobs, but the reality is, I don't sort of know how to ask this. I'm just going to ask it. The reality is you are unlikely ever to get the top NBA assignment, which is the NBA Finals, which is now owned by ESPN ABC, which Mike Breen has. The reality is you are unlikely to call the Super Bowl on television. I know you've done many on Westwood One, given that at CBS, Jim Nantz is the number one, or at Fox, it's Joe Buck, and Michael's in NBC. How do you approach that as somebody who, you're at the echelon of your profession, but because there's so limited opportunities for the top job, it's out of reach for most people except that one person?
I think that we all that are at the network level just feel so blessed to have these jobs. We have three daughters, and I used to tell them when they were growing up and going through high school, which is, if you're a father and you've got daughters, you know what I'm going to say.
I got about 17 or so years before that. Before they get to college.
I'm telling you what, man, they get to 13 or 14, you're going to get the dad Heisman, and they're going to say, Dad,
take care.
No more talking.
Right.
But if you're looking at what the dress that Susie's got on, or if you're looking at the new whatever that Betsy has, you're not worried about what you are becoming and what direction you're going and where you should be looking. And the same is true in broadcasting. If you sit and look at, gosh, I'd love to do this, or I wish I got that game, or I wish I had this partner, or I wish I had this assignment, you're not worried about the assignment you've got right now. And we have all been around people in this business that have been like that.
Right.
And it's cost them. And not that I had a moment that I fell into that. I think my dad probably just always said, kind of what Belichick says, just do your job. If you worry about being the best broadcaster that you can be, hopefully, or whatever you are in life, hopefully, things fall into place. And so I tell my kids that. And I have to tell myself that all the time. I mean, it's a business with great perks, and some guys get these assignments and some guys get the other assignments. And I can't sit and worry about what I'm not getting, but what I can control is the job that I'm doing that particular broadcast that night, that afternoon, wherever I may be. And so I've kind of bought into that. And at the same time I say that, it was something that I would tell my daughter, who's just gotten out of college and is in the business.
Right.
I said, just always try to be, you can see how others are doing things, but just try to be the best that you can be, and just know how fortunate you are to be in that position. And how many kids are in my position, how many guys that are in this stage of their careers would die to call an NBA playoff game, would give anything to work with CBS and broadcast the tournament, or broadcast an NFL Sunday, or do a Monday night game for West. I mean, I I tell myself that all the time. In this business, you're kind of smacked back into reality, because I get a lot of emails from college kids, from young broadcasters around the country, and I think about where they are and how I got started. I was incredibly fortunate to get a pro job right out of college, but how so many have to go to small town after small town and the mid-sized market, and they work their way up. And sometimes it happens, and a lot of times it doesn't. So I think about those guys, friends of mine, that have not had a chance to ever have that. So would we all like to do a Super Bowl on TV or an NBA Finals on TV? Absolutely. Am I jealous that Mike or that the other great NFL broadcasters that are the number one at their respective networks do it? I'm not jealous. I appreciate how hard they work to get there. And I'm thankful. My last line is I'm thankful that I'm at least in the conversation to be lucky enough to doing something I like, and that I would wake up every morning and feel like, how lucky am I that I get to do this game, or I'm broadcasting something that I've wanted to do since I was a kid. So I don't think a lot of people can say that. I'm blessed enough to say that I can. And I never take that for granted. And I do think that's been a pretty good compass for me.
You mentioned your children. I want to ask you, I would have asked you later, but you brought it up now. I want to ask you just a couple quick questions about Olivia, who now is a college football reporter for the SEC Network, I believe. She works for the Hawks for Fox Sports Southeast, and I think probably does some other things. Is it obviously you're proud of where she is at such a young age, but what is it like to have a daughter who is getting some rather high profile assignments at a fairly young age in broadcasting for anyone?
Well, it's a little scary, to be honest. We're obviously, my wife and I are incredibly proud of her, and she works so hard. And I think that's the one thing that I see in every game that I do, whether it's with Allie LaForce or whoever I'm working with, a female sideline reporter for basketball or football. I know how hard they work. I know how many young women would love to be in their place, and they do too. They realize that they're lucky to be there. So when she was a senior in high school, she said, "Dad, I think I want to get into broadcasting." And I told her all the things that I've always thought that I might say if this ever came up. That we've got three daughters, and our son is our baby, and he's still in college, but this is our baby girl. And I said, "You know, it's a difficult business, Olivia, and I work with a lot of women that are in the business, and I know how hard they work, and I know it's lonely, and it's tough, and it's not easy, and it's a weird environment. It's a weird culture. It's just different, like than so many jobs. And you've got to have humility, and you've got to have thick skin, and you've got to have, you know, because a lot of times people are going to grade you on not the words that come out of your mouth or the information that comes with a well thought out sentence, but it's going to be, how does your hair look, or what kind of jewelry do you have on, or what, you know, whatever. And it's going to be more based on that than, you know, the substance of what you're saying and doing. And so, you know, we had these long talks, and she eventually was wanted to get into news. So she was on that path. And Georgia is an outstanding university for broadcast journalism. And they taught her well. But she did a lot of stuff. I told her, I tell every college kid that comes to me, get internships. You need work outside the university boundaries. You've got to work in a commercial market. You've got to work for free. You've got to work on weekends. You've got to work late. And she did all that, all in college. She missed a lot of social time by doing all these things. And as I saw her going through this semester after semester and year after year, I say, you know what? I think she's got the right work ethic. So then we started polishing off her skills and talking about, you know, I wanted to give her a roadmap in terms of voice and camera presence and things that I thought were important, that the earlier she learned them, the better it would be. So I picked a couple of female news anchors, actually, and news reporters at the networks that I thought had a great, great presence on the air, talked with authority and confidence, with great tempo and pace and resonance. Her and I have talked about voice and all these things for hours. But she studies a lot of tape, and so she found a couple women that she respected and liked, and liked the way they sounded and looked and did their news reports. And so she had kind of a roadmap to follow. And then now she has kind of gone off on her own tangent and gotten into sports. And she was still in college, Richard. She was in her first semester, senior year at Georgia. And she got a job doing the SEC on Fox Sports South. They had a game of the week, and she walked basically off the street. And 2 hours after they interviewed her, they hired her to do sidelines. So she would go to class all week long as a 21-year-old at the University of Georgia in the fall, drive to the Atlanta airport, catch a flight, go to a Southeastern Conference school, do the interviews on Friday with the coaches and players, do the game on Saturday, drive or fly back, and then drive to campus late Saturday night or Sunday morning, and then go and study Sunday night for classes on Monday. Hmm. So she had that in college, and then that led to the Hawks sideline package with the NBA, where she's done 3 years. So she has worked for ESPN, where she does still, with an emphasis on the SEC network last year for the first time, and doing the NBA, and does then the ACC show weekly for the ACC, their official TV show. So we couldn't be more proud. But I think she's finding that you know, a lot came her way early, a lot of success. You know, she didn't go to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and work as a sports reporter and do some general news assignments. And she didn't have to go that route from a small market to a mid-sized market and work and do cable access and do all these different things. She went, while she was in college, right to regional sports networks and then eventually ESPN. So obviously we're proud. It's a challenge. She's learning a lot. She continues to learn a lot, but we're incredibly proud of what she's done.
I have two more off Olivia. I read something in my preparation for this interview. She did an interview with GQ magazine. They're online not too long ago, where she said, you know, one of the things that's tough for her when it comes to social media is when they will, when people will tag you on tweets that she gets, whether it's sexually suggestive, whether they're saying she's not good, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know how often you are on Twitter or social media, but if you are, is that sort of difficult to see, given that it's your daughter, even though you are in the business and you understand very well that both male and female broadcasters get this?
I think that we have kind of come to a nice position as father and daughter about what's out there. There's an understanding that there are some pretty dark places out there, and that she has to have the reliance on her, you know, inner strength to, you know, if she wants to look at, and she does interact, and I am not on social media. I am on social media as a news source. I follow a bunch of writers, including you, and I use Twitter only as a news source. I get story ideas, or if you follow the different networks, they'll throw up a statistic or a great story by one of their writers, and that will lead me to that story that I may not necessarily see. So that is what I use Twitter for. But I do not open the door into what they are saying about me. I've seen other guys in this business crumble and just get crushed by things that are said. And Vern Lundquist had a conversation with me one time about the cruelty of social. And you know what? I list every word he said was seared into my mind, and he locked the door for me with what he felt he was going through, and so he doesn't do it. He didn't do it, and I don't do it. But this younger generation, and my daughter is 24. She just turned 24 a couple days ago. This is what they do, and her bosses encourage, as do the CBS and the Turner executives. They encourage us to get out there and be socially prominent. They want pictures and video clips and bits of information we may pick up and behind the scenes pictures. They want us to do that because they see the synergy and driving interest and on and on. And some of us do it and some of us don't. I don't think Ian does. I don't. I'm very comfortable with that. Maybe I'm missing something, but I'm afraid to look. If there's anything really significant, my daughters will tell me because they do go in, but otherwise I don't. But she does, and But you know, my wife is incredibly strong. She did a great job with our girls, and they've taken a lot of her very strong characteristics. And my daughter, but the youngest, Olivia, she has applied that to what she's doing and handling that, which is, as you can probably appreciate, having your social background, media background, and dealing with it. Like, I mean, there's some pretty nasty things that can be said.
Yep.
And it's for a woman, I think it's probably even more hurtful because there's anonymity, and that's what makes it tough.
Vern Lundquist, who I've gotten to know very well in the last 2 years, told me just how kind of rough a time it was for him in the SEC for a number of years, essentially after every game, whether he made a mistake, and pretty much every broadcaster makes mistakes during games, but it got pretty brutal until this last year, which was a celebration for him, and obviously it was pretty much a love-in, but you are probably wise to do that because I think he maybe even on this podcast, Joe Buck told me that it was getting to the point with social media where he would respond to people on Twitter during games, and it would affect his broadcast. And he just said at a certain point, I have to stop this because if I don't, it's gonna consume me. So I think you have the right attitude there. The last one for you. Listen, I never thought I'd have to ask this, so I'm just going to ask it straight. And a reader asked me to ask you this as well, and that is, you know, we have had people in broadcasting who have broadcast the games of their children. Bob Greasy doing Brian Greasy. Obviously, Jeff Van Gundy did a finals broadcast where Stan Van Gundy was the coach of one of the teams. You are potentially now, because, and I think they have made this public on their social media accounts, that Olivia is dating Sam Decker, who plays in the NBA. Is it odd for you to potentially call someone who is involved in a relationship with your daughter? And does the viewer need to know that, or does the viewer not need to know that in the same way? It's probably a little bit different if a dad is calling a son, or in Van Gundy's case, a brother's calling a brother.
You know, I've never really thought about, you know, if anything, we're from Wisconsin. They met through Wisconsin contacts, and that's how they've gotten together, and they are dating. And Sam is actually out now. He had a broken hand.
Right, I saw that.
Subsequent surgery about a week and a half ago. So, you know, that's a great question. If I need to make that known before a broadcast, if it would continue on, I mean, who knows what will happen, but to be honest, people go, well, when you do it, the Green Bay Packers, where your dad worked for over 30 years, do you feel anything for them? Or when you do the Kansas City Chiefs, where you were the voice for 9 years, or when you do the Kansas Jayhawks, as I did this past tournament, did four of their games, Elite Eight, Sweet 16, the round of 32 and 64. I am a graduate of the University of Kansas. Do you feel like there's favoritism? And I am as honest with them as I'll be with you. I really do not care if they win. I don't. When my dad was the president of the Packers, I did games for Fox and CBS for the Packers nationally or on the networks when he was in charge of the Packer organization. Not once did I ever say, by the way, just for clarity's sake, my father is the CEO and the president of the Green Bay Packers. I never said that. Whether I will with this, I'm not sure. But I do not care who wins. I am so selfish with our broadcast. I'm selfish for our crew up in the booth, for our truck, and all the work that our fine men and women do in getting the different parts of information, whether it's graphics or tape, and all the time and hours they put into it. It would be unfair for them if I was up there openly rooting or favoring one team over the other because I've got some kind of connection. I do not care. I hope for a great broadcast for CBS or a great broadcast for Turner. And that my first Super Bowl for Westwood One, the Packers, when my dad was with the Packers, played the Pittsburgh Steelers.
No, wow.
And yeah, so I mean, talk about a conflict of interest. I did not care if the Packers won. I did care that I had a very good broadcast, that I was prepared and focused and my voice was strong and all those things. That is what I cared about. So I don't think that I'll change much regardless of what happens with this situation. He's a great boy. He's a terrific young man. But I don't know. I mean, you know, like you said, people that will dig, I guess they'll find those things out. But like I said, I did a lot of the Green Bay Packard games. Never once said that my dad was there for 35 years. Never, never. And, or never once when I do a Kansas game, say I'm a Kansas alum. I haven't done that, but you've given me food for thought, as you normally do, because you always bring up interesting things, whether you're writing them in SI or on these podcasts, which I listen to. So I'm gonna have to think about that a little bit harder, probably.
Well, first of all, I appreciate you answering the question, and and thank you for that. One thing before we get to partners, and that is, you did the Kansas City Kings. That's prior to becoming the Sacramento Kings, and I did want to ask you. And maybe I should have found this, but I didn't find it. Were you the broadcaster for the Kings' final season in Kansas City?
I was, yeah.
Wow.
I graduated from the University of Kansas in 1982. And the day that I got my diploma and walked down the hill, there's a big hill that leads into the football stadium, and the family and friends are all up in the stands. And we walk down this – it's majestic. We walk down this hill. We walk into the open end of the stadium. We file into the seats. They have the ceremony. The day that I graduated, I got a call from our radio station that the Kansas City Kings had an opening. The station wanted me to fill it, that I had to meet with a guy named Joe Axelson, who was the president and general manager of the team, and would I be available to come into Kansas City? I was in Lawrence, to come into Kansas City and interview. They had heard a tape, and they were fine with it. The other voice had gone off to do another team out east, so there was an opening. They were having some financial problems. I was young. I was cheap, and so just the intersection of luck and being available. And so that I got that job when I was 21, and I thought it was interesting that my daughter got a job at a network level with ESPN, but she started doing stuff for the Atlanta Hawks in the NBA when she was still 21 years old on the sideline. Doesn't happen very much, but I did the final season in Kansas City and had the chance to go out to Sacramento. And again, luck, as I'm trying to make this decision, the voice of the Kansas City Chiefs, a guy named Wayne Larrabee, who now does the Green Bay Packers, had just accepted the job to the Chicago Bears. Well, I was 24. All my buddies were in Kansas City. My school was just 45 minutes down the road. I was still single. I loved the town. I wanted to stay there. So I met one afternoon with Lamar Hunt, the late, great Lamar Hunt, called me into Arrowhead Stadium. We sat and talked, and he hired me, and the decision was made for me. I didn't have to go to Sacramento. Not that I didn't want to, but I would have preferred to stay. I got a chance to get in the NFL. And so that's how I got the Chiefs job.
Wow!
And so that really was incredibly fortunate. I was when Fox got the rights for the NFL from CBS, they got the NFC. I'm doing the championship game between the Kansas City Chiefs, who were led by Joe Montana, at Buffalo, AFC Championship game 1994 for the 93 season. And I'm walking, I've just finished interviewing Marty Schottenheimer for the Coaches Show for the Chiefs Radio Network. And I'm now in my ninth year broadcasting the Chiefs. So I was 30, whatever I was. And I'm walking across the field. It's cold. It's blustery. And two men are walking toward me. One is Steve Sable. And the other one is Carl Peterson, who's the general manager of the Chiefs. And Carl's got this big smile on his face. This is before the game. I'm walking back up to the press box to go do the game with Len Dawson. And Carl says, Kevin, wait till you hear this story. Wait till you hear this story. And Steve Sable goes on to tell me that Fox has called him and asked him to give him, in his opinion, the best three radio play-by-play guys in the NFL. And I was fortunate enough that he mentioned my name among those three. And that's how I got the job at Fox, because Steve Sable of NFL Films, who listened to all the highlights with every team every year, thought enough of our broadcast to put me in that position. So wow. My first year at Fox, I'm with Buck, Kenny Albert, Tom Brenneman, and me. Those are the four guys. And then above us, we had Stockton, who was going to be the number two guy, and Summerall. And so that's how I got my network football break, because wow. Steve Sable thought enough of my work with the Chiefs to get me that job with Fox.
Did not know that. All right, a couple more here. You know, we mentioned earlier in the podcast just how many partners you've had. And particularly, I want to ask you about basketball. You know, off the top of my head, Reggie Miller, Danny Ainge, John Thompson, Doc Rivers, Doug Collins, Chris Webber. And again, I'm sure there's a ton more. But, you know, every person I just mentioned there has a different personality, a different basketball background and mind, and in some cases, very different levels of television experience. So I'd love to know what techniques, if any, you use to build on-air rapport with them. And having talked to many, many broadcasters over the years, one of the things that always seems to be a truism, Kevin, is that in order to get on-air chemistry, you have to hang out off the air. So you go out to dinner or you just spend some time as people, and it makes the on-air stuff that much easier, maybe clicking that much faster. But I would be interested, just given even the six people that I named, they're all so different in personality, age, and experience.
Well, I don't necessarily buy into that. They do want you to go out and spend time with them. I mean, there's a lot of that talk. I think you either click or you don't. And the best I've ever worked with, I mean, I enjoy who I'm working with now, and I've worked with a variety of people from Grant Hill to Reggie and Chris and Greg Anthony and Mike Fratello and all these guys that they are shuttling in and out, Steve Smith, all these guys that we seem to rotate week to week on Turner. So you've got to be nimble, but I enjoy them all. But either you click or you don't. There's a, you know, and we have these broadcast production meetings the morning of the game, and we all kind of know each other anyway, even if we haven't spent a lot of time. So the other night, Chris Webber and I were doing the final game in Auburn Hills for the Palace, and Chris and I have worked probably 10 games together over the years, and it's like we've worked 10 years together. It's just we've got, you know, our personalities just match. And I find most people that our executives feel are good enough to be on the air are usually good enough guys that you can mix with them, and you can always find some common ground. Doc Rivers was phenomenal. We were together for a couple years at Turner. Doc was incredible. Thompson and Ainge, that was a traveling circus. They were a hoot and wonderful, warm, completely different personalities, but truly great. Steve Kerr, who I worked with quite a bit at Turner, he was phenomenal and just was gifted in so many ways, and we're seeing the same thing now as a coach. But the guy that I guess I had the longest run with, 7 years at TNT, was Doug Collins. And Doug is a lot like Rich Gannon in terms of incredibly detailed, oriented in every part of the broadcast. He works so hard. His mind is incredibly sharp. He has great insight into players, coaches, teams, cultures, all these different things that I just found fascinating. Like, I always learned something, Richard, every broadcast working with Doug. But so Doug is probably the smartest, sharpest guy that I've, a basketball guy I've worked with, the easiest, most fun, who we've done probably 20 games over the years, is Bill Raftery. And I see Bill 3 times a year, and it's like we've spent the last 40 years together and have every inside joke, every little nuance. For whatever reason, we just, like, he'll begin a sentence, I'll finish it. I'll start a sentence, he'll finish it. And it's like a symphony. It's just like this, like, it's, I don't know what it is. And I'll get home off a plane and I'll drive home and my wife will watch and she goes, I cannot believe how easy that was to listen to and how much fun you guys seem to have. And we do. But Bill is the reason why, because he is so unique. There's only one like him. He's so easy. He's smart. He's engaging. He's just, he's at the top of his game. He is a man in full right now. He's doing this Final Four. There couldn't be a better guy to do the Final Four because of what he's meant to college broadcasting. So there are different guys for different reasons. But I got to tell you, I really don't buy into this. Well, you got to spend some time with them. And I don't know that, how, for me at least, it's not that true. I guess I feel I can get along with anybody, so maybe that's, and some guys aren't like that. They need that time. I don't personally, though.
All right, Kevin, I want to finish up on two things. The first one is on September 12, 2016, a fan runs onto the field during a Monday Night Football game between the Niners and the Rams. It's not a very good game. And you give a play-by-play call of this fan going on the field and eventually getting tackled by security. This call goes viral. It's downloaded millions of times. When we talked, you had told me that, I don't know if it was either Kimmel or Fallon, maybe Jimmy Fallon. You basically got offers from late night shows to come on after it. There's so much interest in this. This call goes everywhere. And the thing that I was struck by, Kevin, when I talked to you for that piece, was just how uncomfortable you were with the fact that this went viral and that you did not want to sort of be known as, I don't even know how to phrase it, as someone who was sort of doing shtick. And how you didn't want basically this call to overshadow the fact that there's a game going on and you had respect for the players. We're now months away from that call. People still sort of love hearing it. What's your perspective now on that and just the fact that just how viral it went?
Well, as I told you then, I don't think I've really changed my opinion that I do respect the game, the people that run the game, and probably most of it stems from the fact that my dad was in it for so long, and that CBS is, you know, I even though this was not a CBS broadcast, I'm always very concerned about how they would have viewed it and how the league would have viewed it. The league, the obvious thing, because they don't want broadcasters to talk about guys that run out on the field, and they never show them, and there's a reason why, and a protocol, I guess it's unwritten protocol. But then I thought about Sean McManus, who's my boss at CBS, and David Burson, and what CBS stands for. And I was incredibly concerned that, you know, how they would react to it. And not because I was fearful. I just know that you know, there is a certain standard that the two networks I work for, you know, hold their people to. And I always want to meet that standard. And as we all do that work there, and because we feel like we're so lucky to be there, and they've been so incredibly loyal. But some of the loyalty you show back is by, you know, making sure that you stay on the tracks. And I clearly went off the tracks on that particular call. So I was concerned on many levels. I was concerned about what the league would say. I was concerned about what my Westwood One bosses would say, what Sean McManus might think, all this stuff. And even to this day, I feel like, gosh, I guess it's okay, but I won't do it again. And a couple guys have run out in the field, and I've been with them. And Boomer did one for me because I wouldn't do it in the Meadowlands during a Monday night game. About a month and a half later, he called the guy. So I didn't go down that road. But I want to be real honest with you here on this. You and I talked shortly after that. I guess the next day, maybe we talked, or at least
right. Yep.
It was within like 24 hours. And I remember when you wanted to visit. And I was nervous because, you know, I wasn't even sure what you were thinking about. Like, how could you dare do that? My gosh, everyone knows you don't talk about these guys running on the field. But of all the things that were written, and my wife can vouch for this, what you wrote and the way you handled it, like, that piece you did kind of, like, settled. It said everything I wanted to say. You conveyed the emotion that I would want to, but maybe couldn't find the right words to say with what you wrote. And that piece you wrote meant more to me and in that particular situation, because that was a pretty volatile time. It was like I couldn't have written it or said it any better than you wrote it. And it was. I'll never forget that. I think I wrote you a note afterwards saying how much I appreciated that, but you handled it just like like I couldn't have asked for anything more.
Well, that's very nice. That's nice of you to say. I'm not very old school when it comes to a lot of people who have written sports television in the past. So I think, like I told you, I think listeners and viewers love spontaneity. I thought it was great theater. I thought it was fun. And I think I told you this. I mean, you already have a reputation for being, for lack of a better phrase, a professional broadcaster. And I think people know that. And then within the larger context of that, you know, you were responding to something that I think all of us might have been sort of feeling in the middle of what was admittedly a pretty tough game to watch. So
it was. Yeah. And I did have my boss right next to me.
Right.
He had Howard Dinneroff of Westwood One. He was right next to me. And as I told you then,
the guy runs out. Yeah, he thought it was great.
Yeah, no, he was. They flew me to New York to go speak to some group of people at some kind of a gathering of media types about a month after that. And the funny part of this is, at the Super Bowl, we have this thing called Radio Row, where we stop by. They invite like 40 of our radio affiliates, our biggest markets, to come to wherever the Super Bowl is, and we all make appearances. Boomer Esiason will be on, you know, for a period of time, and different days. My day is on Friday, after I've done my NBA game for Turner on Thursday, so I get there Friday morning, and they line me up with 34 radio stations that are still on the air. Every single one of them, before they asked me a question, played that clip. Every one of them. It was like, oh my gosh. I don't know how I'm going to look back on this. You know, you work so hard in this business to call the right kind of nuance to a big play, and all the hours of preparation. And as my wife said to me, and she keeps me pretty humble, she goes, isn't it going to be amazing that maybe at the end of the day, this is what you're going to be known for, is this guy running on the field?
It could be the case. It's not inconceivable. She might be right about that.
It's turned out okay. And to tie it all up, I was at the Super Bowl this past year. I had not seen Sean or any of my superiors at CBS. Because when we have our meetings in August, we see them then, and we see them for the NCAA tournament meetings in March. So when we go in August, we don't see them the entire football season. We may talk to them on the phone or get a text or whatever, but we don't see them. So I'm going down the elevator on the Saturday afternoon before the Super Bowl, and I've just done an interview with NFL Network, and I'm going down the Super Bowl down this long escalator, and at the bottom of the escalator, turning the corner, Sean McManus, David Burson, Harold Bryant, Les Moonves, all my, I have not seen them. And I go down there and I take a deep breath because these are pretty important guys here. And I'm going down, I take a deep breath and go, I was the first to speak. I said, I'm looking down at the end of this escalator and it's like I'm seeing part of my family here at the very bottom. And they all kind of chuckled at that. And all they could talk about was the guy running on the field from September.
Yeah.
So
it's crazy.
So I guess it turned out okay. And if they're comfortable with it, I'm comfortable with it.
All right, here's the last one, Kevin, and I appreciate you giving me extended time here. I'm looking at Turner's NBA on TNT playoff schedule for this week. All right, I want to run this down for you. You know this, but I want to give my listeners some context. On Sunday, you do the Thunder Rockets. On Monday, you do, this is today we're taping this, you have the Grizzlies at San Antonio. You don't work Tuesday. On Wednesday, you are back in Houston for the Thunder Rockets game 2. You don't work Thursday. Then on Saturday, you don't work Saturday. Back on Sunday, you have the third series. You have the Clippers Utah Jazz game 4. That's a crazy schedule with crazy travel and 3 different teams. We talked about preparation, but here's the last thing I want to ask you. And I don't often ask broadcasters this, and I feel like I should because it's sort of part of the profession and interesting. When you're sort of traveling this much, not only is it mentally taxing in terms of the preparation, 3 different teams, maybe different partners, different crews, et cetera, but you're traveling. So it must be taxing on your body. How do you just approach this as both a mental and physical journey in terms of trying to make sure that your body is healthy enough for this kind of travel schedule?
Well, I don't think you can relax unless you feel prepared, and the NBA preparation is a little bit easier because you got less bodies. And I've seen a lot of these teams because we usually broadcast the better teams throughout the regular season. So the preparation, you know, becomes a little bit more less stressful, not as voluminous. So getting ready for these games is the basic process, and I begin the same way with every game. I make sure that I've gone front page to back of the release that every team puts out, which is about 25 pages.
Right.
And then and that takes maybe an hour to go through really, you know, succinctly and detailed. And then from there, I make sure that I've got my newspaper stories read. I go check a couple of websites that have been reliable with outstanding NBA writers. I like to hear takes that they may have and angles that they're pursuing, or maybe a quote that they've gotten from a player. I try to make it a point in my broadcast always to mention if I've gotten, you know, some information from a certain writer. I quoted just last week Zach Lowe, who had done some nice work on, I forget now what it was, but he was talking about it. I think he's talking about the Washington Wizards.
Right.
And he had a nice detail. I respect Zach a lot. I don't know him. I've never met him, never talked to him.
But very talented guy. Yep.
And so I do things like that, and then I feel like, okay, then I can get a little bit of rest in. I work on flights. If anybody asks me what I'm doing, I try to be as polite as possible, but I know that more times than not, if I tell them what I'm doing and what I do, they're going to want to get in a conversation, and that's one of the biggest, most stressful things I go through, because I want to be kind, and I would probably do the same thing if I were flying and saw someone working on something to me that I had an interest in. But if I've got work to do and I've got a very short time like this week to do it, I'll say, oh, it's part of my fantasy football, or it's part of my fantasy basketball, or, oh, I'm just a big fan of the San Antonio Spurs or something like that. I try to be as nice as I can. They won't recognize me, so they wouldn't know if I'm who I am. And then they usually just go about, but I've told them what I've done in the past, and it's taken me away from my work. I need that work time. So I've got to be very organized in terms of what I do. Then I try to maybe, like the players, maybe if I can close my eyes for a half hour in the afternoon of a game, that's great. I try to get to the arena a certain time before the game. But I will tell you this, I, for whatever reason, the good Lord has given me a pretty good constitution where there are times in my schedule where I don't need a lot of sleep, and I am running on adrenaline, which probably is the case this week. And I've had much worse weeks than this week in the past with the combination of NBA, pro football, both pro footballs, and even a college basketball thrown in. So this week actually is pretty mild. I've had 6 and 8 days, which is really tough. But there have been a lot of broadcasters that do that, so I'm not alone in that whatsoever.
Kevin,
but sleep is pretty important. A lot of fluids are important. I try not to miss any meals, and it's funny, you know, when you've got to answer the bell. I just have really never struggled with, you know, exhaustion or fatigue. And I guess I'm always just so excited like a fan to be at the game, and the crowd gets me going, and the enormity of the broadcast, the importance of the broadcast to the people that sell it, to the people that are back in Atlanta or in New York that you know, have hired me to do the game, the responsibility of the leagues. That's a whole other story. Responsibility to the NBA and the NFL to do the best job I can. I guess I just feel like, I might collapse after the game, but I don't, Richard, that really has never been an issue. I've had bad schedules, but that really has not been an issue for me.
One of the,
thank God.
One, as we wrap up here, my producer Lou sent me a note here saying, is calling game one the hardest to call of a series and then it gets easier, or does it not necessarily like work that way in terms of working into a series?
Well, it's hard to drop in. It's hard to parachute into a series. Because every game, it's like this book, and it's got, let's say, a book has 7 chapters, and if you're picking up a book and opening up to chapter 4, game 4,
right?
You know, it's pretty hard to go backwards and go forward at the same time. If you get game 1, you've had the body of the regular season that leads into this kind of a turning of the chapter or opening up a new book. And doing game 1 is actually very easy because all the storylines are fresh. There's a myriad of possibilities. There are all kinds of stories that may develop, and you're right there at the very beginning of all those stories, of all those different things that may happen. If you come in, like tonight we're coming into game 2, and that Utah Clippers series later in the week, we're going, I think, into game 4 or 5 and 4. And that's difficult to try to catch up what you've missed. and then get ready for the present, and then make sure you can spin it enough to see, you know, where this could lead to. And that becomes kind of a dance. Like I was saying with the NFL, when you drop in and see the Pittsburgh Steelers for the first time week 7, well, you've got to go back and look at the first 6 weeks. What's happened? Who was signed? Who was cut? Who was injured? Who started? Who was benched? You know, who had the big game? Who didn't have a big game? Who is now just picking? So there's just so many things you've got to catch up on, and then just try to get up to speed, you know, by that seventh day, by that Sunday. And so, you know, those are all challenges. I'm not complaining at all. Believe me, I feel very lucky. But those are some of the different challenges I think that we all as broadcasters face at playoff time, because we're all doing different series, like you said.
Kevin Harlan, you can hear his work this week and throughout the NBA playoffs on TNT, Turner Sports' NBA channel. He also, of course, works for CBS Sports. He is the voice of Westwood One, so you will hear him if you are either driving around or at home listening to the radio on Monday Night Football. Kevin, are there any other employers that you have gained during this podcast? Have you gotten any other jobs?
Can we do this? At the beginning of football season, can you have me on again to talk for 10 minutes about the difference of doing TV football and radio football?
Yeah.
There's sometimes a lot of aspiring broadcasters that would listen to this.
Yeah, we'll save that.
And that might be a whole show unto itself, because it's different. But there's nothing more rewarding than doing a good radio broadcast, because there's so much on your plate to do that it's so fulfilling, and so it's voice and it's word usage, it's reporting skills, it's all these great elements of our business that we're in, you and I both, and that's a fun discussion to have.
We'll do that. We'll say, I mean, you've given me 77 minutes of free time right now, so I feel like I can't take more advantage of you, but that's good. We will ring you come the end of August, and that is a good topic, because I'm always fascinated by the people who can morph between television and radio, because it's such different skill set, and the mechanics of each are very different. And then you
can tell me how you morph between being a good writer and being an on-air person, because I think that's tough. But I think that's what all these kids in college have got to be able to do. If I'm going to journalism school, you got to teach them how to be in front of a camera presence, how to talk and do podcasts, how to write, how to tweet succinctly. I mean, think of the different kinds of ways now that these kids out of journalism schools,
you're right,
are coming into our business, and all the things they've got to do now that 15, 20 years ago they didn't have to do. They just had to write for one edition of their paper a day.
It's ridiculous.
You follow up story the next day.
Yeah,
now they got all these different things they got
to
do.
At this point, me and you, we might as well have gone to school on horseback. Like, that's how long ago whatever our journalism education was in college, basically.
That's right.
Kevin Harlan, thank you very much for the time. I've always admired and appreciated your work, as many others who listen to this podcast do. And we will definitely have you back in September for that conversation. Best of luck this month with the NBA. It's great to watch, and it's great to watch you. Thanks so much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
You're so great to have me. I'm thankful, and I'm thrilled that you asked. Thanks so much, and I'll continue to listen and read all your great work. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Richard.
All right, back in the studio with Lou Pellegrino. Lou, we were just sort of briefly talking on air before we hit the record on this. That was great. I know I say that a lot. These guys are interesting, blah, blah, blah. I find everybody pretty much interesting. That's not bullshit. And then secondly, as I was saying, Kevin Harlan really could teach broadcasting, because in the way he answers questions, he's so micro into the business and micro into his own preparation and how to get better as a broadcaster that, I mean, he's probably not going to do that. But to me, if this guy went to University of Kansas, he really would be great as a college professor in broadcasting, because he looks at it, you know what I mean? He looks at it as a micro, as opposed to, I'm just showing up. I can't really sort of describe what I do.
What I got from that interview is, this is someone who loves his job, who loves every experience he's ever been a part of, and it actually sounded like it pains him to shut down other people that are sitting next to him on a flight, because he really can't waste time.
Right.
and not prepare. So he can't sit next to me in, you know, row 1B in, on an airplane. And I say, oh, what do you do for a living? And then it's, well, I'm a broadcaster. Really? What do you do? Well, I'm going to do the Spurs. I'm going to do the Spurs Grizzlies game tonight. Oh, really? So tell me, what do you think? Then that's wasting his time where he's going to have to get all his numbers and notes and storylines written down. So I felt like it pained him to actually say, I really can't expand on what I do and tell you because it's going to lead to a conversation that's going to prevent me from doing my job.
Yeah. I mean, he just sort of the detail with each answer was really interesting.
Yes.
And I appreciate him answering questions on his daughter. One, it can't be easy. Two, she's becoming a high-profile person sort of within the places that she's at. And that's just got to be interesting. You know, we always hear from like Joe Buck or people like, you know, we hear the reverse. What's it like to have a famous dad in the business? We don't often hear the sort of the older person or the parent talk about the child in the business. And that,
right.
That was pretty interesting to me.
I really found this to be just one of the best inside type of conversations.
Yeah, I agree. It was really good.
I've been around this for a long time now. Whether it was being a producer, whether it was being an on-air talent, whether it's being whatever, I've been around it. And that was, to me, one of the most in-depth storytelling sessions about the business. And not even so much stories, but just information
right.
about the business. The Steve Sable story
that
I
had never heard.
I had never that heard
amazing.
That before. But yeah. The one thing I will say about Kevin Harlan is, Kevin Harlan, I've listened to him call games for years. I never... ever got a sense that he's rooting for one team or another that he was broadcasting. Now, granted, it was mostly national games, so I didn't know where his childhood and teenage allegiances lied. I knew about his father with the Green Bay Packers, but I've watched games, and there's never been one twinge of Homer or I'm rooting for this team or that team in the game that I'm broadcasting, and I love that about his calls.
He was really good. And I'm glad we had him. I've been wanting to get him on for a long time, and I appreciate that. So thank you to Kevin Harlan. The previous podcast, the one right before this, was in the roundtable with John Orand and Jimmy Trina, and that tracked really well, as did the Jim Miller one from a couple weeks ago.
And thank you to everyone who put the hashtag classy. We reached a ton of people on Twitter.
We did
from the roundtable.
We did get a lot of people for that. So thanks very much for listening. We'll have some good ones coming up. Heading forward, for my producer Lou Pellegrino, for the folks at Digital Media, for those at Sports Illustrated who support this podcast, Ben Eagle, Ryan Hunt, John Worth, I'm Chris Stone. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.